Where did your house come from? Unless you live in a tree, it probably didn't just sprout from the ground. Unless you live in a log cabin in the woods, the materials probably weren't there to begin with. And unless you live right next to the manufacturer for every single material you need for a house, they probably traveled for a long distance to get to you. So, how did they get there?
Your entire house that you live in came on a truck. All of the brick, all of the block, all of the cement, all of the plywood, all the shingles, all the siding came on the back of a truck.
That's Quash Hopkins, a truck driver who operates locally in Massachusetts. And it's not just your house that comes on a truck.
Everything that we have in society, unless you live close to a processing plant, comes on a truck. I just delivered fish, and now I've just picked up a load of Starbucks coffee. Picked up ice cream, pizza rolls, you know, your toothpaste, your toilet paper, your PlayStation 5s, your laptops, your favorite sneakers.
The supply chain is so ingrained in our lives that we barely even think about it. But if you take the time to look a little closer, you realize that there's a lot more to it than things getting to where they need to be. Today, we're popping open the hood of the supply chain and taking a close look at individual stories of people whose lives are affected by it.
Imagine a big, burly sea captain. You wouldn't expect him to be scared of anything, right? Turns out, even he has experiences that shiver his timbers. So this captain devotes his life to teaching students to be confident and competent out at sea so that they don't face the same fear. Let's hear from Malachi Macon.
Captain David Mackey, a veteran maritime officer, had a nerve-wracking first job experience on a ship. I mean, while talking to a conference room full of college students, Captain Mackey said that, well, I think it's better if he tells the story.
I was 22 on a 1,000-foot-long natural gas carrier coming out of school and left out of the, going through the Greek Isles over there. I flew over to Greece, got on the ship. Captain said, okay, fixes every 15 minutes. I'll be in my room if you need me. And I looked around and I had a helmsman who was my dad's age, and it was me. You know, those knees were knocking, but I'm like, well, I got to do it. So, yeah, I was pretty scared, to put it bluntly. But you learn quickly.
Nowadays, Captain Mackey teaches at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy, guiding its cadets into a future career in maritime shipping. Cadets have to go through a lot of training at the academy before graduation, and part of their training involves a ship simulator. But not like one that's just on a computer. It's a full room-sized ship simulator. You walk in and the walls are all one big screen, showing a digital version of the world, as seen from the bridge of a cargo ship. Under the low red lights, you see a multitude of replicated instruments and panels in front of you. Things like a compass, electronic navigation and depth charts, and so much more. And with a change of a few settings, the virtual ship appears to pitch up and down as it moves through the waves of the ocean. And you lean with it as if you were there.
You know, this will be a capstone course where they can use all their navigation skills. They learn each one of these pieces of equipment independently, and now they can put all that together, and we can allow the cadets to make errors.
That way, cadets can be as prepared as possible for the real world. Now, of course, there'll be some things that they weren't expecting to happen. For example, in the ship simulator, Captain Mackey explains,
the first time on a 1,000-foot-long ship, to watch the wave hit the bow and literally be able to watch the wave come under the ship and the ship undulate underneath it. I'm going, holy cow, I thought this was made out of metal. Well, metal bends, right?
But if they ever find themselves in a situation like that, then they'll know what to do.
So their knees aren't knocking like mine were the first time I got up here and the captain went down below and said, call me if you need me. Yeah, I need you. All right, there's a ship out there, I need you. We're expected to be able to handle the job.
And as Captain Mackey said back in the conference room, they are certainly able to get the job done.
And these guys are workers. These guys are intelligent, they're educated, they're trained, but they know how to work. They really know how to go to it.
For For our next story, Tova Kleiner will tell you about a group of people who have found a creative way to haul trash. Here's how they become intimately familiar with the waste they collect and their neighbors because of it.
Every Monday, Wednesday, or Thursday morning, you might hear the sighing of the garbage trucks inching up and down your street, the beeping as they back up, and the loud rumbling of their engines. But in Northampton, Massachusetts, trash pickup day looks a little different. It looks like a trailer on the back of a bike.
You know, I'd describe to people what we were doing, and they'd be like, no, you can't do that. You can't haul trash on a bike. I'm like, well, we are.
Ruthie Woodring is one of the co-founders of Pedal People, a bike-powered trash hauling co-op. We met her and her fellow haulers in a school parking lot, right across from the waste transfer center where haulers drop off their loads. They brought out one of their bikes and trailers to show us, skeptical as we were, that it is indeed possible to move trash by bike. In Northampton, there are no municipal waste collection services, so Pedal People are in high demand.
We pick up for over 1,000 households and businesses, and we're the biggest local hauler.
Unlike other types of hauling, working on a bike allows Pedal People to closely observe all of the stuff they pick up. And there's nothing more personal than someone's garbage.
Do you, like, make perceptions of people based on their trash?
Oh, yeah. And sometimes it's really wrong. But sometimes you make perceptions of people not based on their trash, and then you see their trash, and you see that things don't match up that way either, based on professed values. And it's good practice to not be judgmental.
Yet, it also offers a strangely touching and humorous way for Ruthie to get to know her neighbors.
I had a customer, they had a baby, they were very excited, they had a baby, and I was like, oh, diapers. And so every week, you know, I'd come to pick up and they had, I don't know, 30 pounds of diapers or something like that. And then I picked up for like 2.5 years, and after like a couple years, it gradually sort of tapered off, and I was like, yes, I outlasted that baby, and they had another baby.
It's the personal connections and impacts that motivate Pedal People to keep doing what they do. Sure, it's better for the environment.
I really want to walk gently on the earth.
Sure, they can make a few bucks.
Can they really make a living? A lot of people think that we're volunteers. They're like, no, this is hard work. I would not volunteer.
And sure, they can pursue their cycling dreams.
Actually, I wanted to be a professional athlete when I was younger. But they say that average career span of a professional male basketball player is like 6 years. And I've been doing Pedal People for 20. So I got my dream.
But what ultimately keeps them pedaling is their commitment to the Northampton community and their love for what they do.
We get a lot of support. Like, you know you've made it when the little kids are dressing up for Halloween like a pedal person.
Pedal People are the trash hauling heroes of Northampton, and this is their theme song.
I saw it sitting there on the side of the street. I could tell it must have been there about 3 weeks. The wind was smelling strong, like something dead and gone. But I knew it wouldn't be long till it was with me, yeah, me. Singing, I love hauling trash. Put another bag on my trailer, baby. I love hauling trash. I'm never gonna stop, cause it never ends.
Thank you so much.
Have you ever gone someplace that looks completely ordinary on the outside, but is completely not ordinary on the inside? Deepta Gupta has.
Oh God, I have somebody I want to introduce you to.
These are the sounds of a wholesale flower market in Chelsea, Massachusetts, on a Tuesday mid-morning. From the outside, it's your typical tall, gray, metal, and concrete warehouse surrounded by an ordinary-looking parking lot. But inside, it's a different world. Flowers fill the space in every color, shape, size, and texture you can imagine, their lush scent tickling our noses. The voices of different vendors echo, describing what's coming in, what's going out, who's ordering, and the sounds of frantic phone calls overlap with carts rolling, stems being snipped, and wrapping paper crinkling. Watching the whole warehouse move to take in and send out flowers, we become curious. What turns an ordinary warehouse into a colorful market bustling with life? We want to understand more about the people who keep it going, so we start talking to them. One person we meet is Paula Parziale, who says she's the first woman wholesaler in the area, maybe New England. Everyone seems to know who she is, and she's in high demand. She's quick on her feet, and it's like she knows every little detail of the supply chain, to the hour and minute things will get here.
If things got here on time, that would make all the difference in the world. And we always get a big delivery on Saturday morning. It doesn't even come until Sunday sometimes, sometimes Monday now. And half of that would have been sold on Saturday and Sunday. Now it shows up Monday and it's not sold. So it just backs everything up in here, more to dump, less to sell, missed sales.
But even when there's delays and issues, Paula knows exactly how to get what, from where, and when.
A lot of things are available worldwide different times of the year. So peony, for instance. Everybody thinks of peonies in the spring, but we can get them in the winter now from New Zealand or from Chile.
And she makes sure to do so for her customers.
Also, if you have a bride or something that has her heart set on something that is not available that time of year, it is available somewhere. So it's very confusing for people. They'll be like, can I get? And yeah, you can. It's crazy, but it's great.
Although Paula might be able to get any flower whenever she needs it, she still takes care with what flowers she stocks.
What's your favorite flower in here?
I couldn't tell you. The ones that sell. There are flowers that I actually personally do not like, and I will not even bring them here. That's kind of strange, but it's personal too. It's like my house. I'm here every day, all day, so I have to like everything.
Next, we talk to John Williams, another flower wholesaler. He's chopping stems of flowers when we approach, and he seems quite lively. John Williams is someone who thrives in the hustle and bustle of the flower market.
Come on a Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, and you'll see this place jumping. I won't even have time to talk to you, believe it or not. Wow. We don't even have time to eat lunch some days. It's a really intense business. It's pretty cool. I like it, I enjoy it.
For John, when the business is booming, he is a happy camper.
People being born, people being married, people dying. It's kind of a crazy business. I love it. I love it.
John doesn't just love his job. He takes pride and ownership in what he does.
You tell your friends you work in a flower shop. Well, how's that little flower shop doing? And say, yeah, come pick some flowers up for your girlfriend. They walk in, they're like, oh my God. There you go, buddy. That's my little flower shop.
We leave the warehouse energized, feeling as if we were let into a secret garden, a vibrant little corner that we hadn't known existed. So much passes through here. So many flowers touched every day by the people who work here and who shared their stories with us.
The New England Flower Exchange is just one of many transportation hubs in Chelsea. Mustafa Al-Ubaidi tells us about what it's like for Chelsea residents to have so much stuff moving through their city.
There's so many truck noises.
We are in Port Park in Chelsea, and next to us are piles upon piles of salt, destined for roads all across eastern New England.
Welcome to Chelsea. It's a pleasure to have you all here. My name's Carl Allen. I'm a planner with the city of Chelsea. So Chelsea is the smallest city in Massachusetts. It's somewhere around 2 square miles. By and large, the community views itself as a blue-collar immigrant community.
Despite being the smallest city in Massachusetts, many of the products that serve the New England area are housed here. From the New England produce market that feeds 9 million people every day, to the flower market where trucks come in daily from all over the country, from a substation that transforms electric power for the local area, to tankers that carry petroleum products through Chelsea Creek so often that they have come up with a special name for the tankers.
There's a special class of tanker called the Chelsea class, purpose built to fit through this channel.
We spent an entire day visiting some places that products go through, all within a few minutes' drive from one another. But what we didn't see firsthand was that within these 2 square miles, There are 40 to 50,000 residents building their lives. How does all of this affect them? Carl takes us a few blocks down to Green Roots Chelsea, a local community-based organization dedicated to protecting the local environment and public health. Maria Belen Power, Associate Executive Director of Green Roots, tells us the impact that the emissions from freight traffic has on the residents.
Then again, no surprise that we have big public health concerns. One of the largest rates of childhood asthma hospitalization, and also concerns around heart disease, cardiovascular disease, and just other respiratory problems.
John Walkie, Director of Waterfront and Climate Justice Initiatives, tells us how the things other communities get to enjoy are covered in the footprints of transportation in Chelsea.
If we were doing the slide presentation, we've got some slides that show like pictures of nasty industrial stuff on Chelsea Creek and then pictures of like the Charles River and the Esplanade and go back and forth and say like, why does one community like Cambridge and the Back Bay get this beautiful recreational asset and then we get this bullshit all up and down the creek?
Chelsea has been carrying much of the burdens of the New England area upon its shoulders at extreme cost to its residents. But Green Roots' role is to stand up for its surrounding community and fight for improvements in Chelsea. The trucks at the Produce Center were a source of concern for residents.
You see these tractor trailers that are pulled up kind of tight to the loading bays, and they were using that as surplus refrigeration. And in order to keep them cold, they were running diesel engines 24 hours a day. And so what the people at Green Roots did is work with them, got some grants, and replaced the diesel engines with electric engines.
So getting that pulled offline was like thousands of pounds of pollutants taken out of the air every year.
But it's not always the case that Green Roots has resounding victories. For example, Eastern Minerals, the company that distributes salt, was not required to cover its salt piles.
We actually fought Eastern Minerals and lost that battle. There were residents that were complaining about the salt pile not being covered, but Eastern really felt that that was too costly, too expensive for them to cover it up. So we lost a battle, but there was some small victories where they are now investing in the community in a way where they didn't before. And so Port Park, the park that you guys were at before, is one of those examples.
When they win, it's hard earned. And when they concede, it's done strategically. And while there are never perfect solutions, and there's always more to do, through the work of Carl, Maria, John, and others, Chelsea and its residents have a spot at the bargaining table.
Now that we've heard from people from so many sides of the transportation industry, do you still remember Quash Hopkins, the truck driver we met at the very beginning? Hopkins told us all about the goods he moves from place to place. But who is Hopkins, and why does he do what he does?
I love knowing that the job that I do, it helps other people. I'm bringing essential products to people. I'm bringing people their soap, their food. That makes me feel good. As a dad also, you know, being a provider is kind of what I do. So it kind of fits within that role that I fill.
Hopkins wishes that more people were aware of just how important truck drivers are to our society and gave them the respect that they deserve.
Just understand that there's people behind the wheels and that we do this not only for our own lives, but for yours too. So if you have a chance, thank a trucker.
Truck drivers like Hopkins, along with everyone else we met along the way, ensure that virtually everything we have in society gets to where it needs to be. But much more than the goods they transport, the people who work in and around transportation live fascinating and complex lives. It's easy to forget, but behind every product you encounter, there are dozens of stories, the stories of the people who worked to get it there. And at the end of the day, it's not just about the things moving around, it's also about the people, every step of the way.
This piece was produced by Terrascope Radio, a class in the MIT Terrascope program, which is a first-year undergraduate learning community focused on solving complex environmental problems. Terrascope Radio was developed in collaboration with MIT's program in Comparative Media Studies. We would like to thank everyone involved in this project. Great thank you to all of the people we spoke to for sharing their lives and knowledge with us. Our instructor Ari Epstein and our undergraduate teaching fellow Catherine Lue Pan for ongoing support and guidance throughout this class. Professor David McGee for directing Terrascope as a whole. Elise Chambers, Joan Silverlicht Epstein, Joel Grimm, and Libby Shu for their contributions to the Terrascope community and for making our spring break trip possible. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. This piece was brought to you by Terrascope Radio 2022. Tova Kleiner.
We interviewed a plant.
And?
It went well.
Sara Hernandez.
This is round basmati rice, gourmet and organic.
Deepta Gupta and Asina Wang.
You can always find life.
You just have to chew a little bit to find it.
Lauren Schrack.
I derive deep fulfillment from all forms of destruction.
Jaden Anderson.
It's Monday, and there was Tuesday, and like Wednesday too, but really, really different days.
Kai Van Brunt.
Ooh-woo.
Mustafa Alobaidi and Gabriel Rodriguez Castillo.
You are the flower of my life.
I am the flower in your life, Ugo.
Eldar Urkumbayev.
But it's valid.
Richard Chen.
Well, let me tell you a story about a man named Charlie on a tragic and fateful day.
Malachi Macon.
Adjusting levels. It smells like fish over here.
Thank you for listening.